Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guests and not me. And my guest today is a guy I've long been interested in. In fact, I've signed petitions for his release without much effect for many years, Marshall Eddie Conway. And Marshall Eddie Conway was one of those brave Americans defending our country, stationed in Germany and doing all the right things, and then came home to the United States to find we had some civil rights problems that weren't being addressed. And his response at that time, in the late 1960s, you can talk about it, was to join a unit of the Black Panther Party in Baltimore. But as it turned out, that unit was basically set up by the FBI, heavily infiltrated by them with other people, and was really, as I looked at the record in preparation for this show, basically an entrapment scheme. Get young Black men to join what was really, in a way, a faux division of the Panther Party and, entrap them, get them in trouble and make the case that we have an alarming danger here. And you were arrested in the post offices.
Yes, that's correct.
The record, and they came and got you and they accused you of murder.
Yes.
Why don't we set the stage and just to hold the interest of people. This was not an isolated case. It was part of a whole national entrapment program. It was shortly after that we learned about COINTELPRO. We learned that there was a systematic campaign to destroy the Black Panther Party, and you were really swept up in it. But nonetheless, you were unfairly convicted. You ended up spending 43 years and 11 months in jail on a murder charge until you were found to have been improperly tried, and 2 years ago, you were given your freedom. So Eddie Conway, who's now an executive producer at the Real News Network, which is how I met him during what has been called the Baltimore riots recently, or insurrection, however you want to define it. I happened to be in Baltimore, and I ran into somebody that I'd only read about, heard about, and here you are. So take us back to, you come out of the Army, you're in Baltimore, and what happens?
Well, I came home because of the amount of riots that were taking place in the United States. At the time, I was a sergeant in Germany, and I was on my way to Vietnam, and I decided to not go to Vietnam and instead come home and see what the problem was and see if I could not work with some civil rights organizations to help fix it. Initially, I got home, I joined the NAACP, and I worked with CORE, and we integrated some workplace where segregation was taking place in terms of Blacks could only get, like, blue-collar jobs, so we were pushing for white-collar jobs. I did that. I joined the fire department, and I was a firefighter for a little while, and then eventually joined the post office. And in the process, I looked at the stuff that was going on in America and realized that more organization needed to be taking place to deal with the conditions that I found in the Black community, which was horrendous. And so I joined the Black Panther Party. And so initially when I joined the Maryland chapter of the Black Panther Party, I thought there was like really some serious flaws. It seemed to me like people were actually partying, and it wasn't a political party, it was a social party. And I thought I could bring some discipline from my military experience, et cetera, and encourage a couple other people to join and try to work on it. Interacted with California, went back out to California and tried to see if we could stand up this structure in Maryland, and we actually did, but a lot of mysterious things were going on and continued to occur, and we didn't have any kind of explanation for it. And so at some point I started investigating. At that time I was a lieutenant of security. I started investigating various members to find out exactly what the problem was, and I discovered that the defense captain, which was the key leader in the Maryland Black Panther Party, was actually a member of the National Security Agency. I called for a deeper investigation because I didn't have the ability to actually go beyond discovering that he was an agent. And they sent a team of experts out from New York and California to further investigate. And at that time, he fled the country. And he joined the Stokely Carmichael's organization, which was the All People's African Revolutionary Party in Canada. After the investigation actually validated that he was a national security agent, it was put in all the Black Panther Party newspapers, and it was broadcast wherever we could broadcast it, and that broadcast eventually reached Canada, and they discovered in Canada that he was working with the Royal Mounted Police up there. The FBI had pretty much made arrangements for him to go up there and to work with the Royal Mounted Police. He did that. He infiltrated and he caused mischief and chaos. Here in Baltimore, in fact, I maintain that he actually caused at least one Panther member to get killed and several others to go to jail. And there were other Panther informers, police informers, in the organization as a result of him recruiting them in there.
So let me just say for people listening to this, particularly younger people, they may say this sounds pretty wild. And I would recommend to them that if they think that, they just don't know the history of that era, because even Martin Luther King was set up by the FBI and his organizations were infiltrated by FBI agents on the highest level. They try to blackmail him and get him to commit suicide. And this was widespread. And in the case of the Panthers, it was a full assault on the Black Panther Party. And I mentioned COINTELPRO because after you got arrested, there were some folks in Pennsylvania who actually broke into an FBI office, got the basic documents, and for the first time, the media was willing to cover the FBI's role in infiltrating American organizations that were legal of all kinds, you know, even the Women's Strike for Peace or, you know, all sorts of groups, environmental and what have you, and basically entrapping people. So people should know that when you say you found these people out. And you were basically set up.
Yes, I did not find this out until later on. But as a result of exposing their agent, I was targeted with the COINTELPRO operation, which is the counterintelligence operation that the FBI operated. And they used all the different law enforcements in America was at their disposal to help disrupt and destroy the Black Panther Party and neutralize some of our members. And toward that end, they actually had some of our key members assassinated in Chicago, in particular Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, in L.A., John Huggins, right, and Bunchy Carter, yeah, et cetera. And in Dallas, in Houston, Texas, another Newton was assassinated. But anyway, what they did in a space of a year and a half, we had 37 state chapters across America. In a year and a half, 18 months, they destroyed 25 of those chapters. And the mandate, and we didn't find this out until after 76, the mandate was to lock up any and everybody, no matter what, and they would sort it out later, even if it was illegal arrest. So in some cases, they actually initiated shootouts. In other cases, they prodded people in the car shootouts. In incidents in Maryland, they had a shootout, and they locked up two members of the Black Panther Party. A day or so later, they came and actually locked me up on my job, accused me of being part of that first, accusing me of giving orders to have that done, and then later accused me of being a participant. And then with no evidence, no nothing, no witnesses or anything, they proceeded to put an informer in my cell, and they let that informer then tell the story that they gave him, and they proceeded to try me, convict me, and illegally. And it wasn't determined that it was an illegal conviction until 12 years later. 12 years later, we actually went to the Supreme Court after a series of court cases all the way up through that 12 years. It was finally determined that this was an illegal conviction and they needed to give us relief, but they didn't. They changed the laws in the Maryland Constitution, and it took us another 32 years to fight to get that relief, that eventually when they could fight no more and they were completely exhausted, they finally let us go.
What happened when they release you finally 2 years ago after 43 years and 11 months in jail, which, you know, I can't even imagine, you know, 43 days.
I think after I got released, I was shocked. I was shocked about the conditions in the community. I was shocked at the plight of the people in the black communities and poor white communities. The housing stocks were collapsing. Drugs was rapid throughout. Unemployment was just off the chart. I was actually shocked to the point where instead of trying to rest and relax and enjoy the rest of my life that I had, I made a decision that I needed to go back to work to get involved, because conditions were worse than they were when I first joined the Black Panther Party. 10 times. I can't even tell you in multiples how many times. It was just really bad. And so
Let's stop there for a minute, because that's a critical observation, critically important observation. Because there's an illusion that somehow conditions have got, we're talking about Baltimore now, where we saw it. There was a lot of discontent, a lot of unhappiness, and finally, we were forced to look at some of the statistics in Baltimore, which some people saw as a, you know, fairly enlightened city and a fairly enlightened state. And, you know, a fellow was even running for president who had been the mayor and governor quite recently. And yet you're saying that, you know, despite the civil rights movement, despite everything we've thought about, here in, you know, this historically important city, where one of the cradles of American democracy, you come out of jail after, you know, the 44 years, rounding out to the nearest month, and you actually find the situation worse, considerably worse.
When I was locked up, say, for instance, Spurs Point, Bethlehem Steel existed, Fisher Body, auto manufacturer, Domino Sugar, Black & Decker, industries exist. And even though black people were getting blue-collar jobs, the people in the community had jobs. Unemployment existed, but it was not to the degree that I discovered when I came back. All of those industries were gone, shut down, closed up, offshored or whatever. To take the place of those industries in rural white communities, prisons were built. To take the place of those industries in urban black communities, incarceration was applied. And so the populations were, both populations were being addressed. One was guards and one was prisoners. And then those prisoners in turn came back to the community, and then they had that stigma, ex-prisoner. They couldn't get jobs. There was no jobs anyway. And so it was a need to have them filter back into the prison system and have the prison system expand. The housing stock, because there was no money, no jobs, no employment in the community, the houses fell apart in decay. The subprime lending thing started right in Baltimore. That's where it started at, selling those junk bond houses in a red line district in those communities and letting the stock collapse. In place of employment and in place of industry in the community, drugs were put in the black community and drugs were put in the poor community. And now that's actually spreading to like Westminster. It's spreading to almost totally white communities suffering the same devastation now. And of course, when you have a large population of unemployed people that's in desperate straits, that some of them are on drugs, etc., violence actually follows that. Policing is increased by tenfold. So there's just all kinds of clashes, and then there's all kinds of hopelessness down on the ground. The young people down on the ground, say, for instance, were walking around like they had been in a war zone, and they had. And I didn't realize it at first, but they had actually been in low-intensity warfare in their community, where they see people getting killed or dying, or every night you hear guns going off. That didn't exist when I got locked up. And no society should go back instead of going forward over a period of 40-some years.
How do you survive 43 years and 11 months in jail and come out being as constructive, purposeful, clear-thinking as you are?
Well, I think the one, you have to know who you are before you go in the prison system. I think that's an important piece of maintaining your humanity. Second, I think you have to engage in making changes in your environment, wherever you find yourself. And third, I think you have to help other people. And it's through service, it's through that work of working with other people that you also maintain not only your humanity and your dignity, but you also maintain your will to survive that particular ordeal. And probably last but not least, you need to kind of like stay abreast of what's changing so that you won't become socially retarded.
But you know, you say that and it all makes perfect sense, but doing it must take you into a nightmarish zone. You're in a system where they're trying to destroy you, trying to set you up, pit one against the other. I mean, I my encounter with prisons is mostly as a visitor and going to interview people, but I just a few times that I was there involuntarily, you know, I'd say, wow, in a matter of hours, it became clear to me that I had, you know, no effective control here. And you're there for almost 44 years. So could you just give some sense of
it? Well, I mean, initially, I mean, it was a tremendous amount of combat, tremendous amount of resistance on my part, you know, fighting back, time spent in solitary confinement on lockup. There were three attempts to assassinate me in the process. But also, there at that time, during the 70s, there was a tremendous amount of people in the prison system that was ready to fight for change and ready to organize and ready to be educated. This is the time of Attica. This is the time of George Jackson. This is the time when prisoners recognized that they were somebody. They were human beings. And so I was not alone. And at some point, I think, in all fairness, oh, we exhausted each other, the prison officials as well as the radical changes. And at some point, we came to an understanding that you leave us alone, we'll leave you alone, but we'll continue to organize. And it was just a matter of how we organize in the future. Initially, we were organized and changed all the things that we thought was wrong, and we won. But then after winning and kind of relaxing, we found out that, well, okay, for all the good creatures, and I'll make a point, we forced them to bring in telephones, we forced them to bring in TVs, we forced them to have family time, we forced them to bring in computers. Once we did all that stuff, we found out the hard way that then that became tools that management used to control the population. Well, if you don't act right, we're going to take your TV. If you don't act right, we're going to not let you on the phone. If you don't act right, we're going to not let you have a family visit. And so then what we found out was that not only did we change things, but we gave the administration tools to work with, but also that we didn't change the population because new people would come in and there was telephones, there was televisions, there was family visits, there was all kinds of picnics. And so they were like, oh, okay, I got 5 years, I can do this. And so the fire left the prison population. And so then we had to go back and revisit what we had done wrong. We hadn't did anything wrong by changing the conditions, but we did something wrong by not changing the people. So then we went back and revamped our programs and started working with the individuals and let them know that they have a responsibility to not only fight for the changes they want, but to help change the community and in itself.
So it's interesting talking to you about this fight, because it's really the fight over a whole people's consciousness and health, because if whatever set of stats you believe, there isn't much disagreement. It's what, one out of three or four black males is going to end up somehow
That's correct.
Connected with the prison system. And then their larger families and friends and associates are all going to be affected by them, their behavior, their consciousness, their example. So you're really talking about saving a people, basically. You got a campaign to destroy the will of a people, break the will of a people, and you're incarcerated, and you're trying to challenge that, right? Mm-hmm. Now, putting on your scholar hat, and, you know, what are the lessons you learned from this?
I think the initial lessons is that you didn't need to fight for all the creature comforts that let people understand that they were humans, but you also needed to figure a way to let people know what their history, what their role is in history, how they come to be where they were, because all too many people blame the victim or blame themselves. It's like, oh, well, I did the crime, I'm doing the time, you know. Not understanding the larger picture of the historical institutional racism, not understanding how capitalism uses populations against each other, various reasons to gain wealth for a small majority. You kind of had to raise the consciousness of individuals in order to change the conditions in the community, because if you don't, then people will come through the prison system and go out thinking that they are more clever than they was when they came in, and they'll end up back in the prison system again and further damage the community. That was one thing. The other thing, and I learned personally the hard way, is that you can't take things from people without giving them something else that will address the needs that they have. And I speak in particular about, like, we had waged a serious campaign about drug addiction and drug use in the prison population, and we had 500 or 600 people just stop using drugs. But the end result was that it led to a number of suicides. And we had to kind of like step back from that and realize that, well, okay, we weren't in the position to give them something to replace that.
Mm-hmm. You've now had time to think about, not much time, you've only been out a couple of years, but, you know, you've thought about it. You thought about it while you were in prison, starting to do your work. And is it deliberate that the larger society doesn't want to educate these people? Is it deliberate that they're seen as throwaway people? You know, they're expendable, their labor is no longer needed. What's going on?
Well, two things. One, the larger society is miseducated itself. The media and the school system, if I will, tends to miseducate people. And they tend, I mean, the hypocrisy that is American democracy, all people are created equal, was hypocritical when they founded the nation. Full of slaves and women without the ability to vote, and even white poor people without property. You know, that hypocrisy has been perpetrated up to today, and the educational system continues to perpetrate it. The mass media, which is 85 or 86% owned by 6 multinational corporations, continue to perpetrate it. And then there's this the boogeyman thing that it's not safe to go in the community. It's not safe to work with these people because they're so dangerous and so on. When in reality, if you go down in those communities, people want jobs. Young people want jobs. And I'm not saying some people don't get the glamour and the glory of being a drug kingpin or whatnot. The average person down in the community that's on the corner, that's risking their lives, that's risking their future, wants to actually work somewhere. There's nowhere for them to work. There's nobody that even listens to them. Nobody goes and reports their stories because there is no jobs. There's automation and cyber nation now. You know, America's still manufacturing to the level it was, but it's not using this population. It's not using its people. The capitalist system has made those people obsolete, has thrown away large proportions of the population because it's no longer necessary.
Yeah, let me just say I'm talking to Marshall Eddie Conway about his 43 years and 11 months jail, what happened before and what happened after. You know, let's talk about your current work. You're an executive producer at the Real News Network, which is, I think, a terrific organization. I witnessed it. I walked into this factory building in Baltimore, and there's all this stuff going on. The media was covering it all as wild animals out there and terrible rioting and everything. I walk in there, and there's a real mixture of, a lot of black, brown, white people in there, young people. They're manning television cameras. They're going out getting the story. And in the middle of that thing, I find you. You know, and you're functioning there. Everything's, you know, we're going to cover this. We're going to understand it and so forth. And I compare that to what all these, really, I would say all these other news organizations are about, which is alienation from these people, contempt for their potential, right?
Yes.
What's the big picture here?
Well, the big picture is corporate news media. And in Baltimore in particular, most of their on-air talent, personality, not only are they white and they're from suburbia, they're pandering to an audience that's in the county. They don't really focus their attention on what's happening in the urban areas other than to report negative stories or stories that create fear and hostility. And the larger current organizations, most of those people are millionaires. So they're sitting there on national TV and they're telling you what's going on, but they're telling it from their perspective. They're millionaires. They're insulated against poverty. They don't even understand what it is to have your food run out toward the end of the month and can't feed yourself, or having no job. They don't even understand that. So I think what happens is that alternative media is now starting to take hold, either through the social media networks, et cetera, radio programs such as this, television programs such as The Real News, and to look down in the community and address those things that's happening down there from the grassroots level and giving people a chance to hear their stories, to tell their stories. That's not going to happen in the major or multinational or media networks.
When I met you in that, you know, heightened situation of what the rest of the media is calling the riot in Baltimore, which I just wandered into. I get up Amtrak and I walked through these demonstrations. I had actually not followed the news very much, and I'm looking around and everything, and then I end up in your shop. Mm-hmm. And what impressed me, and it's important to understand, because everybody says, oh, media, what's going to happen to media? You know, the New York Times is in trouble, big old, you know, CBS, how are they going to make their money, the business model? The fact is, there, you had people doing a professional job. And if people want to check that out, just look at the interview that Paul Jay did with Eddie Conway. You know, it's professional. You're lit right. The sound is right. The technique is right, you know. On the other hand, the content is a world away from the content that we get, which is dismissive of people, of ordinary people, of their concerns. Do you see yourself doing this for a while?
Don't let this get out, but I would do it for free.
Yeah, I'm the same way, you know, but it gets a little tiring. Yes. I've done it for free. It gets a little tiring, you know, no, I know what you mean, and 'cause otherwise you'd just be a crazy person walking down the street muttering to yourself. Now you got an outlet, you know. But you think it's a model that you can that can be sustained?
I believe it can be sustained, and so far it has been. As long as the public supports it, you know, with small donations, we're going to grow and we're going to develop. We're going to expand, and this is something that people need in order to reassert their independence and to reassert their ability to affect change in their community.
I want to conclude on this. It's Robert Scheer. I've been talking to Marshall Eddie Conway, otherwise known as Eddie Conway, and to a large number of people, not the majority, your cause, your case was a glaring case for all those 44 years of an innocent man being held in prison. And the authorities not giving a damn. not caring. But I want to pick up on this point of optimism. It's interesting because some people listening say, well, you know, those founders, they weren't of the country. They weren't all great. And there was this enormous contradiction. And then some were slave owners and blah, blah, blah. You know, and it's all true. But it cheapens that history if you think they all did it with their wigs on, because you had a radical like Tom Paine, and, you know, he didn't have any money. He didn't have any resources. He was kind of on the lam from the Brits, you know, and he scrounged up some money, did a pamphlet, did grassroots journalism. That's what Tom Paine did, the greatest writer of the American Revolution, the greatest propagandist and spokesperson for the American Revolution. Tom Paine was a guy who was maligned, and actually after he died, you know, critics dug up his grave and threw his bones to the wind. And looking at you, you don't look like Tom Paine, but I think the spirit is there. But when I go into newsrooms, any newsrooms, and here we are doing this from a school of journalism, where we train journalists at the University of Southern California, and I look at those rooms, they are quite often the children from the suburbs. They are quite often people, you know, alienated or indifferent or unknowing about the community that they're attempting to cover or should be covering. What you folks have been doing, and, you know, the idea that there's an executive producer who 2 years ago, you know, was in the prison system. And now he comes out and he can help us understand the impact of that prison system on people, what happens to them after, what happens to them before they get swept up into this thing. And that's the way to cover the news about the greatest crisis this country has, which is its indifference, its contempt, its hostility, and to the vast base of the population. Because as we're seeing, and maybe it's a little editorial on which I'm ending, but, you know, even if you look at the Trump phenomena and who he's appealing to, they're people alienated. They're not getting the jobs. They're getting out and they're in debt, you know. They're not doing well. So the American dream has soured for the white working class, you know. And I think that this perspective, you know, that journalism should be done by the grassroots rather than by the elite. You don't only just have to hire people who come out of Harvard. They can come out of prison, which is what Real News did. They gave you a job when you came out of prison.
Yeah.
Okay. So why don't we end with you just tell us how people can read more of your story and learn more about Real News.
Well, you can go to realnews.com and pull up stories. You in the search box, you can put my name, Eddie Conway, in it. Or you can go to any of the other ways in which you can get it, podcasts, etc., Facebook. And you can buy, purchase the books from The Real News. And you can look at the interviews or you can look at the stories. And not just my stories, but there's like 10,000 stories or more so far. And so and we cover everything around the world. And there's a large network of journalists working toward that end to keep people informed from the level of people down on the ground, the grassroots.
Well, that wraps it up. Thank you, Eddie Conway, for an incredibly inspiring story. And I hope people do follow your lead, get the book, check out Real News, and see you around.
Okay, thank you.
That's it for Sheer Intelligence. My guest has been Marshal Eddie Conway, who's certainly been a great source of intelligence on the issues we have to face. Our producers have been Josh Shear and Rebecca Mooney. Sebastian Grubar at USC has been the engineer on site. And Kat Yor at KCRW.com in Santa Monica.